Und was machst du am Wochenende? Hier ist der Podcast für die zwei kürzesten Tage der Woche von Zeit Online und Zeit Magazin. Wie immer mit der Schriftstellerin, Radiomoderatorin, Podcast-Gastgeberin und gerade an ihrem neuen Roman arbeitenden
Don't say it!
Ilona Hartmann. Hallo Ilona.
Hallo Christoph, das war die Stimme von Christoph Arment, Editorial Director des Zeitmagazins, bekannt aus dem Podcast Alles Gesagt und dem Newsletter Was für ein Tag und natürlich auch diesem Podcast hier.
Absolut.
So ist es.
Vielen Dank, Ilona. Auch diese Folge wird produziert von Charlotte Steinbach, die gerade kurz mal aufgestanden ist, um das Fenster zuzumachen, wie ich vermute. Sie nickt. Falls ihr Wünsche habt, Kritik, Gästewünsche, schreibt uns an wochenende@zeit.de. Wir haben heute einen Gast aus London hier. Werden deshalb auch gleich in seine Muttersprache wechseln, haben allerdings schon gehört, and I don't know if that's as true as you want to talk about it on tape, that your German, one of your favorite German words is
Gewürzgurken. Did I say it good?
Yes, yeah. Perfect.
I just love
Gewürzgurken.
Yeah, I love them.
What's great about Gewürzgurken?
I just think they're crunchy, they're sweet, they're pickly, they're salty, and they can make a boring sandwich really interesting. They can make salsa verde better. I love it in a stroganoff. I'm just all about the pickles. I think pickle is a spice of life.
Why is that?
Because, you know, pickle is just potential. Pickle is just, do you know what I mean? Like, and not specifically the Gewürzgurken, but the world of pickles. Yeah, I just think, like, cooking without pickles is just boring. I love it.
Ihr habt schon gehört, es geht heute ums Kochen, denn wir haben einen der berühmtesten Köche der Welt in unserem Studio, one of the most famous chefs in the world. He has published over 35 books, I think. Is that correct number?
I think we're like 26.
26.
Something like okay. That, yeah.
And he has sold over 15 million books?
No, I think we're heading towards 50.
50.
50, yeah, 50. We're getting close.
Und er hat auch ein neues Buch veröffentlicht, das ich auch hier habe.
Yes, it's
there's a new book that you've just you're just publishing in Germany.
Yeah. Have you got it with you? Oh yeah.
Yeah, I have a copy with me. It's called Genial in German. Maybe you want to read it in German.
Okay. Ein by Jamie Oliver.
you know
genial,
that name.
Genial one pot. Gereshet, how do you say that?
Yeah, geniale one-pot Gerichte.
Okay, I should have rehearsed that. It doesn't roll off the tongue, does it?
No, I mean, it's not.
Well, maybe even, for you, but not
a German
for me.
Never does.
Exactly.
Yeah, one.
And one is about what?
It's about our hatred of washing up.
That's so true.
And it's about the optimism of easy, quick midweek meals, really. I mean, you can cook them any day. I mean, it's a book you can use. Some of the books I write are more for like dinner parties and the weekend and special occasions. This, I wrote this book to be the most user-friendly cookbook that I've ever written. You know, 25 years of experience. Like, the recipes are almost the last part. It's the psychology of us now
mm-hmm.
and the new cooks or not now. And what people expect now. We, as in Brits and Germans,
yeah.
We know quite a lot about food. We see and read quite a lot about food. We like food, but we don't like washing up and we don't want to spend loads of time and we don't want loads of ingredients and we don't want to spend loads of money. So we want quite a lot, but we don't want to give too much, you know. So, and to put that into context, you know, in my career in the last sort of 20 years, the average time spent cooking has halved in the household. So, you know, phones, even COVID, you know, and yeah. technology and meal delivery services. This is all part of, I guess, the perception of progress. But my belief is that, you know, the nearer we keep us to understanding food, where it comes from, how it affects our body, and how joyful it can be in a billion different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, you can cook for romance, you can cook for health, you can cook for meditation, you can cook to console yourself with a hug and feel better when you feel down. You know, it's a really powerful force, but it's a force that's being kind of edited away from your average person's life. And that, I know you might think, well, is that really true? It's definitely true. This is all I do. This is all I do. And the most powerful industry on the planet is the food industry. Mm. And they don't really want you to cook. They want to give you a solution. That's where they make their margins, really. So, you'll see in this book, I mean, the ingredients list is very low.
That's what I was going to point out. Like, very early on in the book, you have all you need on one page, yeah, as a basic ingredients. And what do we see there? Two different oils?
Yeah, well, I say my pantry is basically like an olive oil, an extra virgin olive oil. So these for me are the healthiest oils and the most delicious, with nutritious benefits. You know, they're heart healthy, lots of polyphenols and deliciousness. Vinegar is probably the most underrated ingredient of all ingredients.
Really, why is that?
Well, it's kind of the backbone of a Gewürzgurken. I mean, what's a Gewürzgurken without vinegar, right?
That's so true.
But it's we misunderstand it. I think the British and the Germans maybe misunderstand.
But vinegar is more popular in the UK, right?
But when you use vinegar, which is obviously fermented alcohol, I mean, it's alcohol that's turned into acetic acid. Like when you roast meat with a swig of vinegar and then it cooks away, you're left with that, you know, and you've got the depth of flavor and the sweetness from onions. You know, when you contrast sweetness and sourness from, say, an onion that's roasted slowly or fried slowly with just a kiss of vinegar. So like no one, when you go to college, they don't sit you down and say, listen, like the game changer. And also, by the way, when I say vinegar, like, if you ever come to my house, I'll bore you with vinegars. I have about 150 vinegars.
Really?
I make vinegars. You make it out of cider, 150. Out of champagne, out of red wine, out of white wine, out of blended wines. Like, if some days, we're getting geeky already. Some days, like in June, when the herbs in my garden are flowering, I'll go and cut that specific day. Let's say it's May the 27th, my birthday.
Right? Yeah.
I'll cut the herbs on that day and I'll plunge those herbs into a big jar of vinegar. And a month later, you won't believe the flavor. That, and the name of that vinegar is May the 27th. And when you make a dressing with that, when you go to the German deli and you get some cured meats, mm-hmm, and you put that with some incredible greens and like some possibly some fruit and some tangy salt, and you make a badass dressing. You could take sprouting broccoli and you dress it, you know, and then from the world of nutrition as well. Like, you know, it's like a lot, when you eat greens in the presence of healthy fats, you absorb more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because a lot of nutrients are like fat soluble.
Yeah, yeah.
So water soluble, fat soluble. So it's like, it's almost like nature wanted us to, I mean, actually nature is vinegar, right? Because it's just fermented stuff. Like, and we're learning now, aren't we, that fermented things, whether it's kimchi or sauerkraut. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Sauerkraut in Britain, like for Britain, we always like the, as we are roast beef, or the French are like, we used to say frog's legs, and the Germans were sauerkraut. Like we've kind of been joking about it for my life. And now everyone's going, oh, like if you go down my market now, there's like 20 sauerkrauts of all colors. And
who would have thought?
They're extraordinary. Yeah. They're not great. They're extraordinary. Mm. And to use them as you would, genius. But again, to chop them up and put them through a mayonnaise, or like, you know, chop them up and put them into a little dressing, or through a stir fry at the end, or a lovely bowl of chicken broth and noodles and like little bits and pieces and tender meat and like chopped up funky sour. I mean, if I showed you the pictures of what's going on in England at the moment with sauerkraut, you would be so proud. You'd be like, yes, viva Germany, we did it. But, you know, so vinegar. We've gone so far away from your original question.
No, that was part of my question. I mean, I've never heard anyone speak about Rotwein Essig, vinegar, so passionately like you have in the last couple of minutes.
Please trust me. Like, it's the secret weapon. And if you've ever gone to your local supermarket, and let's just presume, by the way, like everyone else, this is normal. And you look at this wall of vinegar and you go, well, I'm just going to buy the same one that I use for that minimal use. If you just take 1 second to read sherry vinegar, champagne vinegar, red wine vinegar, this vinegar, that vinegar. Like, and you go and make a French dressing out of some of the, and the more money you spend, by the way, you'll just get some extraordinary, that salad that you like, Well, just you take one tablespoon of a bit of vinegar and it's like, boom. So I think that's the joy of cooking. And also that we're very lucky in Germany and Britain now, like the ingredients from around the world that we have to our, you know, our grandparents never had access to these foods. And we're able to buy a humble piece of chicken or fish. And we can literally take that piece of chicken on a holiday every day. Like, where do you want to go, sister? You want to go to Korea? Where do you want to, go to France? You know, do you want to go to the mountains of Germany? You know, it's like, for me, this is the excitement of food. And I guess my job in the 25 books is I've never run out of recipes. I've never struggled to write recipes. The reason is because the challenge always changes. So the customer's changing.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of my old customers aren't with us anymore. The new ones, which were kids when I started, are now young adults. They believe and see and live in a different way. Mm-hmm. Of course, technology kind of tricks us into progress. But really, for me, a lot of the answers for the future are in the past. And do you know what I mean? So this is just, I mean, of course, this is full of love, heart and soul. And every page I sweat for and test for. But it rings nice. I mean, I'm just trying to use a quirk and a reality, like the appeal of one pan to try and get more people cooking. And of course, in the old days, well, first of all, I never thought I'd publish a book. So there was a British audience. And
then the book started to travel.
Yeah, but I didn't even, I promise you I didn't. I never understood the concept of distribution. Mm-hmm. And I just never thought about it. And we're like 20,000 copies away from 6 million books in Germany. Like, this is really unusual. This is, as an English boy, I find it quite emotional and really surprising. I know I've worked hard for it, but also that genuinely does change you. Like, because anyone can look at a video for free. Anyone can like it. And in a country where in this country, the book price is the book price. Back home in England,
it's different.
It's very competitive, and they do. So
they don't have the Buchpreisbindung, as we call it.
I feel so lucky to connect with an audience that isn't within my born culture, you know. And so that's part of the joy of my job.
Like every episode of Und was machst du am Wochenende? What are you up for on the weekend? The novelist in this room, Ilona, has done some extremely good research to find out about your weekends.
Wow.
And in a literary way, she will now read out her little piece. And then we talk about what's actually true and what is fiction.
Cool. I'll do my best.
This is the part where we're both scared.
When you've got 5 kids, anything's possible. So I'll start off saying it's probably true. It's probably all true. It's all happened.
Oh, you just say yes, no, for sure.
Exactly.
I'll try that.
So since we have our first chef on the show, it was for me very obvious where this would be going. So here's the recipe for Jamie Oliver's weekend. Preparation time. 0 minutes. We're busy. So first, chop the 2 days into fine slices of 1 or 2 hours. Take a bunch of free-range kids. Let them simmer on low heat in their own juice. Stir once in a while. Cut yourself in half and spend 12 to 16 hours on a medium heat in bed.
Wow.
Place the other half in a big bowl with slightly too big plans and marinate there for about 6 hours until all energy is absorbed. Fry brain cells with social media consumption until golden brown and crisp. Grab a big chunk of your never-ending list of things to fix around the house. Swirl together with a bunch of old friends you haven't talked to in ages, and let that just sit at room temperature. Season to taste with a good amount of Sunday scaries. Top it off with a generous order of pizza and decorate it with calling your mom.
Wow. There you go. That is a piece of art right there.
It is.
I mean, you know, some of it's very familiar. Some of it's very familiar.
Which one was familiar?
Calling my mum, catching up with friends, having to cut myself in half or quarters or eighths.
Right.
I mean, the weekends are very precious.
How do you actually spend your weekends? And when actually does a weekend start for you?
Yeah, but you're on point. Like, I would say 5 o'clock on Friday, that's the weekend start.
And what happens at 5?
I cook for the kids as they arrive back from school. And my wife is normally completely fried by Friday. Mm-hmm. So I will cook for River, who's my six-year-old, who's an extraordinary kid. But my God, is he hard work. Like he is literally like...
In which way?
He is... I think he thinks that he is a prince or like a king or something. Like, we all work for him, basically.
It's the sign of the times.
Yeah, I guess. But he is... He's interesting. He makes me look much more normal than like he's struggling at school with like conventional learning.
Okay.
But this kid is bright as hell. Like, he builds stuff out of magnets and draws stuff in 3D at six. Like Rain Man. Like, he's kind of like on 10 cylinders. So he's like a 50-year-old in a 6-year-old's body. He has a repertoire of words much better than mine. He talks like an old English gentleman, he uses these big words and wants us all serving him. Very clever, really.
Well, he has understood something about British aristocracy, the royal family and everything. Yeah.
I think he thinks there's an opportunity for the new role. You know, maybe that's me. Yes. Give it 10 years. But no, I cook for him and he's probably my, of all my kids eat generally very well, like but he's my most awkward in the sense that he just loves protein and carbohydrates, and like my normal techniques of getting the good stuff in him are he just destroys. Like, you know, it's like normally, like, you know, I'd lose fruit.
What kind of trick usually works?
Well, the only thing that really works is a long-term plan, and parents always want a short-term fix, but like certainly a short-term fix is like you hide stuff. Because you just want them to get the nutrition, right? So they're growing, they're developing, like in their brains, in their bodies. So like things like smoothies or like little homemade ice cream yogurts, that's really easy. And you can literally lose anything in there. So I kept my kids all firing on the most incredible food through drinks and like incredible scoopable yogurt ice creams and Cornets. And, you know, you could do it that way. He's having none of it. No, nothing. So I think he's literally on two fruits, blueberries and pears. That's it. That's all I can do. But it's fine. He's healthy. But no, I get him washed, bathed and put to bed.
Yeah.
And then the second that he goes to bed is when the weekend starts and the gin comes out. And my wife, she doesn't drink alcohol, but she loves coffee. So I make her a really, really good coffee.
What's a really good coffee?
Well, she basically good quality, like local, you know, roastery, like... grind it, rattle out like a double espresso, and she likes a cappuccino at 7 o'clock. Don't ask me why. I know it's weird, but I've told her it's weird.
My Italian, she doesn't care.
My Italian brother-in-law says, no, get cappuccino, 11 o'clock in the morning, finish. No,
Italians usually explain like cappuccino and latte macchiato is always only for kids.
Kids and breakfast. But Jules loves it, and I want her to be happy, so I will no do discussion. And then I kind of like, you know, like when you read tea, do you know when you read tea?
Yeah.
And you look at the signs at the bottom. So I pour the milk, and if it comes out in a sexy shape, woo, I know it's on. Do you know what I mean?
Friday night.
If it comes out a bit, you know, average, then I'm like, oh, damn. If it comes out a little bit like boobies or a Gewürztraminer, then yeah. So I give her her. Yes, true. Honestly. This is I let the coffee beans decide. That's probably why I've got five kids. It's the way I pour it. Anyway, this is so random. Anyway, I know I have a gin and tonic, and then I cook dinner, and then the weekend progresses into lots of kids' sports, and I am a human taxi service. I cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I love it. I go to my market on Saturday mornings, which is a real old-fashioned town market, like real fishmongers.
Do you have a special routine where you go first? Which stand you visit first?
Well, I go with River, my six-year-old.
Yeah, gentleman.
The mayor. He's the mayor of the town, basically. I mean, he's not officially the mayor, but he doesn't care about the officiality.
Well, that's how it starts.
He walks around that market, like, honestly, like, I have to... I do all my errands. I can't keep hold of him. He's like a wild dog. He's gone. He's best friends with everyone. He's negotiating deals, and he comes back with new clothes, new bags, like food all over his face, a bit of sausage hanging out of his pocket, you know. And I do my errands and my chores. I get my bits and pieces and talk to people and you know. And then I have to literally go around every single market store to say, do I owe you any money? Because River thinks there's no currency. In River's world, everything's just a gift.
Well, he has you.
Yeah, I know. It's fine. But sometimes like I find things when I get home. And it's like, you know, you always respect the market stalls, right? Yeah. Because they're hardworking. They're there. Yes, they're there in the sun, but they're there in the rain. They're there in the snow. But I get home and there's a bunch of stuff. There's like 15 euros, 20 euros. It's like real money, you know? And I'm like, River, you didn't tell me. Oh, I've actually now got all of the market people's mobile phone numbers. I have to text them and say, are we square? And he's like, no, it's actually $7.99, Jamie. Thanks very much. Lovely boy. It's like, anyway, so that gets me. And then, of course, Sunday lunch, you know, is a big thing. Is Sunday lunch a big thing in Germany?
It used to be. It used to be. I think it's more or less, I mean, I'm not hearing so much
ever
about
since
it.
You leave home, it stops being a thing.
But there used to be like a big tradition, like for Sunday lunch. So is it still a tradition in the UK?
I think it's massive, yeah. I think it's huge. And also, in my opinion, the things I love best about British cooking are very German. No one ever talks about it, but British cooking, proper British cooking, not, you know, get away from the kind of PR and the cliche. Proper British cooking and proper German cooking are unbelievably similar in structure, in flavor profiles. A lot of the things that we love dear are from German descent. So, you know, I really notice it when I go around the Black Forest area, Bavaria. Like they're going, oh, this is very German. I'm like, that is my nan's cooking, like 100%. So I think, interestingly, although culturally, you know, we've got differences, under the skin of it, we are much more similar than people give us credit.
What's your favorite Friday dinner dish for your wife?
What was my wife's favorite thing? I think it's actually meat or a really good pasta dish. Like I did a really nice dinner the other day, just a lovely rack of lamb, smothered in like herbs and loads of black pepper and mustard and just pressed in like breadcrumbs and herbs. And I roasted it hard, crisp, crisp, crisp. And I did dauphinoise, you know, like that milky, garlicky, like thin slice of potato. Yeah. And then I've grown some celeriac. I don't know how do you say celeriac in German?
Celery.
Yeah.
Celery. Right?
But the root, the big fat one, yeah.
Yeah, that's there is a Stangensellerie and Knollensellerie.
Yeah, there you go. I think it's the Knollen one. And
the Knollen one.
Yeah, it's like, but it was delicious. She loved that. Mm-hmm. So she's more like, I love fish, so I go to the fish market every Saturday. But she's always like, she loves healthy. So my wife's very well until she got COVID, which has sort of knocked her a little bit. But she was always like really fit, very like active physically, and then loves to eat. I always take the mickey out of her because I just call it bird seed, you know, like everything you should have, and she's so loyal to it, like fermented kefir and like seeds and nuts. Oh, it's perfect. It's perfect nutrition. But she does love meat, so.
Right. So, you know, we at Zeit, we have a weekly food column called Wochenmarkt, so which is like the German word for the weekly food market, and the columnist, and she's also a publisher of a magazine now. We're publishing a magazine called Wochenmarkt. I have a copy for you in a minute.
Beautiful, thank you.
I talked to her before today, so I asked Elisabeth, you know, do you have a question for Jamie? And she said, well, I don't have a question, but I do have a question. What does he do all day? Because he's, you know, he's the most successful cookbook writer in the world. He's the second best selling writer in the UK, right? We talked about it, Ilona.
I think if I researched that correctly.
Yeah, it's J.K. Rowling and then there's you, number two.
There, just to be clear, there's a very big gap between me and her. like I'm on Earth, she's on Mars.
But you're still on the moon.
I'm
the only one.
Yes.
Number two.
I'm very lucky, yeah.
So Elisabeth, who's a hardworking woman editor, asked me, like, you know, what does he do? Like, why is he still so busy? I mean, he's been so successful for so many years.
I feel like publishing's probably the most unexpected, if you'd have seen a 13-year-old Jamie, mm-hmm. you would have put money on this never happening. Because mm-hmm. I really struggled with the concept of words and reading.
Right.
It was a battle.
Yeah.
And
was it diagnosed at the time?
Or? Yeah. I'm dyslexic. So yeah. like it's pretty, I mean, I've got D's and B's running all over the place. Sometimes mm-hmm. that I just see things wrong. Mm-hmm. Now I've had to live with it. I mean, part of being dyslexic is problem solving. So you get around it. So actually my first three books were written on a dictaphone. And each little cassette would be a chapter. And then, you know, I'd get someone to type it up. And then right. I can read like a magazine very efficiently. But I've only ever read one narrative book in my life.
Which one was that?
It was actually Hunger Games 2. and I know it's not the most editorially profound book. But
well, I haven't read it, so tell us about it.
Well, I saw the first one. And and I loved it so much. I I do quite like that. My wife hates it, but I love that sort of fiction. And the first one was a brilliant film, I think. And then I couldn't wait for the film. So, but basically what happens is after about 11 pages, I fall asleep. So
because it's so tough and exhausting.
And I can be, if I'm doing auto cue, which is kind of part of my job, like the room could be refrigerated so cold and everyone's got jackets on. And if I'm trying to cook and read autocue, I'm literally sweating buckets. So definitely like there's something with the wiring not quite right. But like I say to lots of kids that struggle with you know, whether it's ADHD, you know, OCD, whether it's, dyslexia, dyscalculia, there's all these kind of isms and they're not fake, they are real. And we all learn differently. We're all wired differently, aren't we? And I think it was part of nature's plan, if I'm being philosophical about it. I think, you know, my daughter's training to be a nurse. And I know from what she's told me that I could never do that job. It's too much. It's like, I don't know how such incredible, largely women, but like, how is it that these people can exist and be so kind and put up?
How did the 13-year-old Jamie Oliver cope with... you know, that disability?
To be honest, it wasn't great back in the 90s or late 80s. I was pulled out of class. I went to an all-boys school,
right?
Like 850 boys, you know, so it's lively, a fair amount of testosterone. and it was a happy school. It was a nice school. It was in a village. But I was pulled out of class to go to special needs, and they called it special needs. So, like... it's kind of geared up for bullying and kind of like a lot of grief. For me, I was okay, but I did see it affect the others. Mm-hmm. There's only like maybe six in the whole year that struggled like I did. But so I guess, probably of everything I've done, to be that and represent that, and then to be heading towards 50 million books and just behind J.K. Rowling, like... when you really think about it, it's amazing. And I think it's because I definitely see things differently. Like, it's not just about the recipe. It's not just about the book. It's about so much more. Mm. It's about tone, and it's about timing, and it's about context, and it's about an energy. And it's like, and I sit when we do campaigns with government and we're trying to like change things for the better for child health, like I sit in the room with like Harvard, Oxford graduates, really super, like genius people. And I have, and only recently as I've started to understand my brain a little bit more, I've said like, look, I'm going to just pop out of this meet. You're all too clever. You're all too clever and you're going to fix nothing. Like you need, and what does that mean?
You've done that.
I've done that because I know that their capacity to come up with some ideas, brilliant, like they're genius. But you need some people that see things differently. Like the British government now, I'm sure this is illegal, by the way. The British government actively employ dyslexics and people with forms of autism to work for like the Secret Service. Why? Because they see things differently. So if you look at a lot of the things that I've done over the last 20 years, it's been a lot about problem solving, teams, and working with, really it's all about people and emotion. And so I It's a funny old, but when you're a kid, you can't work that out. And I speak to a lot of kids and I try and do as much as I can to let young kids that struggle know that this is not the end. You know, it's because if you don't fit into a square shape, it's all over, you know. And I
think,
yeah,
especially
you know,
when you're young, it's all about fitting in and being part of the big group.
Being the same.
Yeah, looking the same, liking the same.
Yeah, you know, Elisabeth, you know, our food columnist also told me that she just recently read this recipe for me. And she said, like, you know, the great thing about Jamie Oliver, he doesn't give a damn about calories.
Can you read the title again?
And the title of this recipe, in a, you know, it's amazing. It's Bonkers Bread and Butter Panettone Pudding Tart. So, I mean, it's crazy. I only read the recipe this morning and I thought like, wow, you know, how do you come up with something like this? And I don't, you know, I think you know what's in there, but it's absolutely crazy.
Yeah,
in the best way.
I mean, ironically, I my life is surrounded by calories, ironically. for me, that's kind of like looking at panettones that are everywhere in Britain.
Yeah. And now in Germany as well. For a couple of years now.
Exactly.
We have panettones for Christmas everywhere. Season. Yeah.
And then a lot of people, they're quite nice gifts. So people get lumbered with, oh, what do I do with this? And then after just having it toasted, like, there's a lot of other things you can do. So for me, it's then kind of looking at history. And you know, there's Germanic and British recipes using lots of bread and sweet fruits and eggs and cream and vanilla. So it's almost like a language. Do you know what I mean? But it's panettone is like 10 times more interesting than just stale bread. So you end up, and then it's kind of, well, how do you cook it? Do you cook it in a bowl or do you, you know, so to do like in a tart form, which you recognize, and you've probably got a mold of some description. So it's kind of a lot of stories. It's a story about theoretically waste. It's something that might get stale or be thrown away at Christmas. That's partly why I wrote the recipe. But also what I love about that recipe is if you make it really badly, it's brilliant. So like I said...
Is that a secret of some recipes that you can't really mess them up?
I try to do... Sometimes when I do recipes and I'm rolling it out and it's going well, sometimes I'll say, and look, if yours doesn't look like mine and it's got a hole or a tear, and then I'll pick it up and tear it, I say, all you have to do is put it back and stick it back together again. So I like recipes when the cooking fixes everything. And with this dish particularly, like you can do it badly, you can do it well. It all comes out beautiful in the end. And it just turns into this amazing thing.
Put it in our show notes, the link. But it's like there's salt, there's butter, 125 gram butter. The panettone, vanilla, double cream, milk, eggs, and then on the top of it, dark chocolate.
Yeah. Happy Christmas.
That's amazing.
Happy Christmas. I mean, look, it makes you happy. Look, there's yes, it's indulgent ingredients, but probably like 90%.
It's lovely.
There's very few healthy desserts.
I can
tell you.
Exactly.
I mean,
who wants healthy dessert?
Yeah, exactly.
I can give you one. I can give you a few, but no, I think, look, it's... it's always about, you know, portion control. And cake is a very honest thing. Cake's never lied to you.
Why don't they lie? They never lie. Why don't they
because
never lie?
Because when you have the second slice, you know you're asking for trouble. You know? But if you think about it, like if you walk down the breakfast aisle in most supermarkets, the truth isn't quite as easy to find. Like cake can be whatever you want it to be, but it's never lied. Like breakfast cereal has, always. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Should be not the breakfast aisle, but the cake aisle, because it's cake.
Yeah.
In an illusion of like extra fiber and extra this and extra that. And usually 7 times out of 10, it's just air, sugar, and very basic grains. But, you know, so I think like the world of cooking and all of that is a beautiful thing. But what I love about that dessert is a non-cook can make it. And be like, wow. And I like that. I always think about the worst cook. When I write my recipes, we test them 5 times inside the office. And then we send them out to strangers. And they have a little form to fill out. And we pay for the ingredients and they do the testing. And
where can I apply for this?
Well, today. the boss is here. Talk to me.
I'm in.
Yeah. It's a nice process.
Hmm. How do you remember the weekends of your childhood?
Oh, I loved them. I was really grateful for my childhood. I lived in a pub, which I think Germans probably more than most. I mean, the nearest thing to a pub is probably the
Kneipe,
the public houses you have in Germany. They're not very common around the world, really. Like, a pub isn't a bar, is it?
And no.
It's not a cafe.
Yeah.
It's not a restaurant.
Yeah. It's, and everyone's welcome. So again, I think this is quite, there's not many examples of that around the world. So I love the pub. There was always something going on. I normally worked on a Sunday from like 8 in the morning, have a few hours off in the afternoon, and then till about 11 o'clock at night. So I did that for most of my childhood from about, well, that from probably the age of 10. But I started working when I was 8, just like peeling vegetables, bottling up the bottles and recycling the old bottles and sweeping the cigarette butts out the front and burning boxes and all the jobs, cleaning toilets, you know, whatever has to be done. So the reason that was important was because I, like any other kid, liked things. Boys particularly like things. So I always had £25 in my pocket, even as a kid, honestly. Like I was never, I always had money because I earned it. And it was like...
And it was yours.
Yeah. And I have £1.20 an hour, you know, rattle out 8 to 10 hours on
you
a
just,
Sunday.
You just touched your trousers. I mean, do you have cash in your trousers?
No, I don't. But I was just slapping my bottom just to let you have that arousing that feeling noise of having money in it. But no, I think it's to earn your money is really precious. And my dad never gave me pocket money. In the summer holidays, I would work like maybe 30 hours. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money, man. Like, but it was good. Like,
what did you buy from that?
Drums. I played the drums, saved up for cymbals, drums, loved like Pumas, like Nikes, sort of tracksuits. It was the breakdancing era, so little feeler tops. You know, like, oh, I had the garms, man. I was looking, the wardrobe was tight.
Were you like a good breakdancer?
I thought I was good. Now, there's a difference between
Did you do the helicopter thing?
I tried the helicopter, never really got very good at it. Couldn't get a head spin.
The robot?
I could do the robot. And we had different villages. And we all
competing
used to...
Competing with
each
other.
Yeah, we had little... About the size of this table, I had a roll-up piece of lino.
Yeah.
And a ghetto blaster. And we used to walk to the next village, roll out the vinyl... And then like the kids would come out and you're like, whoa, and you sort of try and outdance each other. I mean, parents must have looked out the window and said, darling, you got to come and have a look at this. Yeah, that kid from the pub, you come and have a look at this. Oh my God. He's spinning on his back. I think he's just broken his arm. What? Oh, what are they doing? But it was almost like kind of fight dancing. That was the
theory. There was a lot of breakdancing, like it used to be like gangs competing with each other.
Yeah, I think it was like driven from America, but certainly in Germany and England, breakdancing and BMXing like was a thing. I think it was a really good thing, actually. Like
Absolutely.
It was really different to our normal culture, and I think it was fun. The music was kind of wacky and weird, but at least it was different, which I thought was kind of interesting. But yeah, look, I used to wash cars. In the village, like for some reason, I'd just knock on doors. Would you like me to wash your car?
Oh, yeah.
£5, you know, inside out, like polish it, vacuum it out.
Where did you learn that, you know, where did you get that talent from making money?
I don't know. I just didn't want to be in anyone else's hands. I wanted to.
Why
be,
not?
I wanted to be independent.
From your parents?
Yeah. I mean, my parents were lovely but because they ran the pub, it's really interesting. And now I'm a parent. Sometimes I think, damn, I'm over-parenting. Like,
helicoptering, as we say in
Germany. Because like I was out all day. I'd come home to be fed and I was out. I was so happy. And because mum and dad were always there, but they didn't over-parent at all. They were very strict about good morals, work hard, be honest, be kind, you know, that sort of stuff. And of course, I try and do that now the best I can. But because that sense of community... Like there was always people watching out. And like if I was doing anything stupid, like someone would just tell dad in the pub and I'd get a bollocking, you know. So, but I did. It was funny because things were not great at school. The pub was my school for sure. And definitely cooking. I didn't know, but my dad was one of the pioneers. I didn't know this until I left to London. But my dad was one of the pioneers of what we call gastropub. So sort of an old fashioned list of recipes that they do in a pub. Very simple, very basic. But dad was like next level. He was sort of like Anglo-French cooking sort of Swiss Germanic desserts, all made on site. Like you'd be like buzzing, like whole lambs butchered, whole fish, lobsters, crabs picked freshly.
So
like meringues, pastry, everything.
You grew up with this sort of in this kind of international cooking world.
Yeah.
Without realizing that
I was making French, Swiss, and Italian meringue by 12.
Wow.
And also I think part of my technique of teaching, mm-hmm. which originated in its physical form, was. And it's not, I'm not trying to give myself any credit here at all, but by the time I was 14, I'd been around the kitchen like three times. So on a Saturday night, it don't matter who you are. If you're working that section, male, female, any age, it's hard. All I can describe the energy is like, if you've ever played Tetris?
Yes.
And you're doing really well.
Yeah.
And you're getting really far up and you're waiting for a four to come. Bling, 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 bling. That's what it's like cooking. Like, that's the kind of energy. But mm-hmm. instead of that, it's kind of like plates of pate and little, like, you know, toasts and salads. And, you know, you're doing like a hot starter and like, you know, it's fast, it's furious. And there's like a chef calling out the orders and there's seven people working as a team.
So not always in a very friendly tone, I guess.
No. The language was terrible. I mean, like, by the time I was 13, I'd heard every swear word you could ever dream of.
Yeah.
And in poetry. You know, it's like it would rhyme, but I loved it, and they were a good crew. But one of the problems I had was when I was like 14, I'd have the new full time apprentices start at 20, 21, and they did not like, because when you go on a section, you're taught by the person that runs a section.
They did not like a 14-year-old.
The transition, transition of a 14-year-old teaching a 20-year-old was not good. And even though my dad was the boss, didn't really matter. So there was that slight physical, right. And I won't say violent, it wasn't violent, but it was a problem.
A tension.
So I had to develop ways to teach them, making them feel like they were discovering it. Because when you set up for service, before the customers turn up, you go through your menu, you cook everything you need or prepare everything you need, but then it's how you lay it out. Think of it like pianos and organs. And drums, right? You have to lay it out so that you can move as least as possible to complete that plate. Mm-hmm. If you've got things all over the place, and it's actually relevant for the home. I always tell people, like, oh, I'm building a kitchen. What does good kitchen design look like? I say, right, what's your most favorite meal? And they say, oh, spaghetti bolognese. And you're, okay, where's your fridge? And you draw the fridge. Where's your hob? You draw their kitchen. And then you do the journey.
And then you built it around spaghetti bolognese.
And if you've got lots of crosses, then that's bad design. Do you know what I mean? So so draw your kitchen, whether it's your actual kitchen or your intended kitchen, and just cook with lines of a pencil your favorite meal. And if that's got crosses everywhere, then that's not ergonomic. So, you know, it's an interesting thing and an interesting childhood. And I saw quite a lot of things as a child in a man's kitchen. We had punk rockers, you know, we had like gothics, you know what I mean? Like from a fashion point of view, you've got all the fashion. So they come to work in sort of like, you know, motorbikes or capris and their music and that attitude. You know, I had one chef that was kind of like a punk rocker that refused to have any small knives. He only ever had, he only had knives like a foot and a half long, like just because. So even when it came to little delicate jobs, like turning potatoes or like doing delicate jobs, he was doing it with something that was 2 foot long.
Werbung. Zeit Online lädt wieder zum Z2X Ideenfestival ein. Dieses Jahr sprechen wir unter anderem über Geld, Demokratie und künstliche Intelligenz. Dafür suchen wir dich. Du bist zwischen 20 und 29 und hast Ideen zu diesen Themen oder arbeitest an konkreten Projekten? Erzähl uns, was wir von dir lernen können und werde Speakerin bei Z2X. Meld dich an unter zeit.de/Z2X Festival. Wir sehen uns im August in Berlin.
Is that where the slightly punk-ish attitude in your own cooking comes from? Because I feel like there always is. There is a little
I think that,
something.
There was probably more attitude when I was young because I was young. And I think now I'm just, I don't mind being like naughty or anarchic or a bit punky or like, you can have fun with it, but really, genuinely, I'm just trying to get as many people cooking as possible. I just feel like it's, so whatever language, do you know what I mean? Like, if I was being a chef that's showing off, it's not that book.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to be a chef that's talking to the widest amount of people around the world, like, and of all ages and of all skill levels, like, this would be great for a beginner or a student, but also if you've been cooking well, you know, so it's just different. I guess I've just developed.
Yeah.
Over the, I'm still a bit rough, but.
When we talk about England and the way you grew up, what's your first memory of the Queen?
Probably first memory, other than banknotes.
I mean, you had quite a few when you were a teenager.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, I had lots of £1 notes. I think Christmas, she would do a speech every year. And in those days, the whole family would gather around and see what the Queen's got to say. And that felt like part of the charm. The first time I met her was when I got an MBE, which was amazing. I was only 28. And I got, it's kind of like an award you get for, like, it's a member of the British Empire. So you'll be very sad to know that you can't get off of parking tickets. That's the first thing I said. I said, this is amazing. Can I get off of parking tickets? You know, and they're like, no, it's just recognition for your fine service to the restaurant industry. But I got that for the restaurant industry, and I'd opened a restaurant that trained kids from tricky backgrounds.
What was it like meeting the Queen for the first time?
Amazing. Bonkers. I didn't feel worthy, really. Because I think a lot of people think a lot of things of me, but I'm still the kid from the pub. I really am. You know, I still think, like, my most valuable morals and thinking is the pub thinking, you know. And even now when I do campaigns for child health, it's all pub. Because the pub is the ultimate democracy. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, and a lot of the things, it's not about us and them or them and us. It's like everyone, you know, I've seen what a good village looks like. I've seen what a good pub looks like. I know what community spirit feels like.
How many times did you actually meet the Queen? Like a couple of times?
I'd say several times, but properly was on the MBE, which was, you know, for my parents, probably one of the best. I mean, they couldn't believe it. And then I took them. You know, me and Dad always dreamt of going to this restaurant called La Gavroche, which was run by the Roux brothers. And it was always too pricey, for us, in the old days. And the chefs would dream of going there. I think it's like 2 or 3-star Michelin. And so I got my MBE in a suit. And then me and Mum and Dad and my wife went down to La Gavroche and had dinner. Very emotional. But then I was lucky enough actually to have, I got an invite through the post and to have lunch with the Queen. And it was just 5 of us in total.
Wow.
And it was like I think it was the head of police and an Olympic rower or something like that.
Yeah.
And me and and the Queen and her husband.
What did they serve for lunch?
They did like a little tartlet, if I remember rightly, sort of spring tartlet, delicate little salad. And there was like a lamb dish for main and like sort of a syllabubby meringue thing for dessert. Interestingly, the menu was all in French, which baffled me.
Didn't the French lose against the Brits?
Yeah, I don't know what the association or the ritual is, but like, if anything, it should have been Germanic. It should have been German, because they got more connections there. But I don't know why it wouldn't be in English, which would make sense. But anyway, we had the lovely time. Her husband was hilarious and so funny. Such good company. She was sharp and interested and curious and fully supportive of anything to do with getting kids and cooking and all of that happening. It was lovely. And as you would expect, you know, run to precision to the minute, to the second, 2 hours, finish. And then I had the guy that runs the room, sort of not a butler, but like the one that just runs it, just said, "Would you like to see the kitchens?" I'm like, yeah, yeah. And took us around the kitchens. But you forget that it's a working office. There's like 800 people to be fed.
Yeah.
But imagine being that chef. Like, you're pumping out like, yeah, we're doing the 100 police or, you know, this, that and the other. And it's like, yeah, you're doing 10 for the Queen today.
What would you have loved to cook for the Queen if you were asked for?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think I would probably, I don't normally worry, but I probably worry about it and contemplate it for days. And I would probably try. There's two ways you can go. Like, if you're ever under stress on, like, cooking something posh for someone posh, like, I normally strip it back. Right.
Very basic.
Really basic cooked food done so well. Mm-hmm. And that tends to work really, really well. Mm-hmm. But I think I will probably tune in, do a bit of research like you did for your poem, and try and get into some of the, like, the nuance. Because I think, like, the best plate of food in the wrong place isn't great. Do you know what I mean? Like, the right food of any type in the right place is genius. So I like the idea of nostalgia. I think I would. I like the idea of. I think as a cook, to respond to your area and where you live is kind of nice. So it's quite nice to get. I mean, I'd buy quite a lot of meat from Royal Estates, which is quite good. She loves game, but I think I probably would make some kind of delicious ravioli, just because I know that's not her normal thing. Fantastic. But what's lovely about ravioli is you could put, if you had like a classic English oxtail soup, you can reimagine that in a ravioli, and it's like extraordinary.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So pretty much anything can go in a ravioli. So I probably have some fun there, and I'd probably do an old-fashioned British dessert. I don't know what I'd do for starters, but yeah, high ravioli. Pressure. I never got to do it, sadly, but hopefully I'll get to cook for the king.
Yes, that was my last question, because you have to go and run in a minute. What would you cook for King Charles?
Whew. Don't know, really. I think I would love, I mean, I think I've known him quite a long time, and he's great. And his, where his space is on food, environment, farming, producers, it's all in the right place. Like, he's well baked in there before it was even trendy.
Right.
Like, he hasn't changed his, you know.
Yeah, he was green before green became popular, especially
literally,
in the UK.
Yeah, so we get on really well. And I think probably I would have to get one of his animals from his estates and roast it the proper way, over fire, spit roast, you know, basting it, loving it, basting it, turning it with like herb brushes and little spritzes of vinegar, of course. And honestly, like just herbs, salt, and like, you know, like when you go to the chemist and get those little spritzers, vinegar, good vinegar in there, like the flavor that you can create is extraordinary. Underneath, catch the fat and like do some outrageous potatoes or vegetables, whole roasted carrots. Anyway, you could have me here all day talking about that.
So we have a very last question.
Yeah.
That's, you know, we just need a brief answer. Ilona has it for you.
Yeah. What is worse, Sunday afternoon or Monday morning?
Sunday morning. I mean, Monday morning. Sunday morning.
Sunday morning. That's the best answer.
We're going to take that.
We never had that answer.
That is like yes, no, sort
for
of.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure. I love Sunday morning.
Yeah.
It's a joy. Oh, I love it. But Monday mornings, you know, you've got to find that energy for the week, haven't you? You've got to dig deep. Dig deep.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming by to our studio in Berlin, Jamie.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a big pleasure. I mean, you know, from vinegar to the queen.
It's been random, and I apologize if I've gone off.
That's our concept, where it's just random all over.
Yeah.
You know. Thank you so much for coming by, and I just wish we can meet again. And I mean, Ilona is gonna, you know, she's gonna try to get into your program.
One pan cooking.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Have a go. I mean, listen, I just think we got to get as many Germans cooking as possible. it's so important, honestly. It makes people, the world a better place, a happier place.
It does. Next time we're going to talk about the film Ratatouille.
Oh yeah. Do you know I was actually a voice in it?
Yeah.
I was the health inspector.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. See, look, now she's interested.
Yeah.
Look at those eyes.
I was all the time.
Yeah. I was the health inspector, the one the rats tied up.
Yeah.
But I was very disappointed. I thought they'd hired me for my voice. Because I have a very distinctive voice.
You have.
And and comedians hate it because they can't do it. And they really, really want to take the mickey out of me, but they just can't do my voice. But I turned up and then they said, no, you're French. I went, what? And they went, you just got to talk like this. Hello, I am the health inspector. That's what I had to do. I went all the way to Disney to be French Jamie. So
do you know what's funny? In German, they showed your naked chef show in the synchronized version, and you have the same voice as Zach Braff in Scrubs.
Really?
So that's why I always got this like sort of catastrophic undertone when I watched you cooking, because I remembered Zach Braff.
Right. Is that a good thing or a bad
hospital.
Thing? Oh, no, bad thing.
Well, it added some sort of vinegary flavor.
It's so good that we have you in the original voice in our podcast.
Absolutely.
Ah, thank you.
Jamie Oliver, thank you so much and happy weekend.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Und was machst du am Wochenende? Ist ein Podcast von Zeit Magazin und Zeit Online. Produziert von Pool Artists.